You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft.
Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Hello, how you doing? I'm Craig Parkinson. You are listening to the Two Shot Podcast. Sit yourself down, pop the kettle on. We're going to have a nice old chat. Who's it with this week? I'm going to tell you right now. How the devil are you? It's Thursday. It's the podcast. It's the Two Shot Podcast. There's many other podcasts out there. I don't know if you were aware of podcasts. But thank you so much for joining in and downloading this, because it's very important. It's not important, but it's dead nice. I am still in Manchester. It's the final week here. And I'm looking out of my big window over up to Saddleworth. I'm looking at the National Football Museum. There's Arndale. It's a glorious, beautiful, blue, sunny evening here in Manchester. And it's episode 94. And we recorded this not in Manchester. We went to London to meet the one and only Mr. Gaz Coombs, who you'll be very pleased to know is one of the loveliest men I've met. I've been a huge fan of Supergrass since they started. So the fact that Gaz wanted to come on, it was a really big deal. I mean, really got down to it. He's really lovely. But I wanted to talk. I sound like he's really lovely. Like I really love him. I do. He's a really nice guy. Yes, I wanted to be my friend. We went out for a few pints afterwards, myself and Griff, and one of his team, Julie, and a couple of his new bandmates who worked on Matador and certainly World's Strongest Man and Salamander, which is the new single. And yeah, we had a really good chat. But first, before we get to that, I want to talk about last week's episode with Jesse Cave, because there was a huge response to it. I'm not sure that everybody realise what they were getting themselves into when they were listening to it, because it did go very deep and it was very emotional. But the response from you, and certainly the messages and emails that we've had, have been very overwhelming. And I know for a fact that actually 2 days ago, Jessie was going back up to Edinburgh and she was going to start doing the last run of Sunrise. That's she's going to put it to bed after this. So if you are in Edinburgh, make sure, who have you got to see? You've got to go and see Honest Amy with Amy Booth Steele is up there. Madame Overy with Rosa Hesmond-Hulsh is there. Both have been having incredible reviews, and I've got a feeling that both might be sold out. So it's going to be literally that quote that you used to see on theatre posters: beg, borrow or steal a ticket. Don't steal, I can't condone stealing, but you know, if you have to steal, just don't mention my name. And now you've got Jesse Cave, obviously. Also, my pal Matt Ford is up there. Where is he? Pleasance? He must be, yes, he's at the Pleasance. Matt Ford is at the Pleasance. Do go try and see him. Again, he might be sold out. But there's loads to see. It's Edinburgh. You'll just have an absolute ball. Jack Rook is there. He's getting incredible reviews. And Jack's incredible. Can I say incredible anymore? No, I can't. I'm going to move on. What am I saying? This week is episode 94. So we went to Soho. We arranged it with Gaz. He was going to come and meet us in our lovely spiritual home that is Maison Bateau on Greek Street. Big shout out to Tanya Wade for letting us have the downstairs. And we got down to it. We spoke about school. We spoke about music, obviously. We spoke about Supergrass. We spoke about all his solo stuff. Let's get down to it. This is episode 94 of the Two Shot Podcast with the mighty Mr. Gaz Coombs. Enjoy. I shall see you in a bit.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
He isn't.
No, you see, that's
he used
thing.
To
that's
play piano, and then he worked in sort of the kind of sales, you know, area of distributing sort of diagnostics.
Yeah, that's why you can never trust it. So that's why I don't do that anymore.
But you can see how they sort of soundbite it, I guess, because the way I just described my dad's old profession isn't very sort of like catchy. So, you know, food scientist works. But you know what I mean? Yeah, it's kind of weird. And a lot of weird information on there. I've never been really asked to sort of change it.
I very rarely go on. That really taught me a massive lesson in one doing these conversations. Yeah. Is to, we'll just find things out as we go along.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
if it's straight from the horse's mouth, then you can't be wrong, can
well,
you?
Well, exactly, yeah.
Was it your leg?
Yes.
Everything all good now?
It is. It's really good, actually, yeah. It's feeling, I tried to run for a bus recently, which was a bit shocking. Just the kind of, just the feeling, you know. Yeah, there's a lot of work to do to get it back up to kind of you know, running around and
how did it happen
playing
again?
Tennis. I was just messing around with my daughter. We were just playing, sort of play fighting.
Yeah,
and
you
it
did.
Just, I don't know if it got too serious or not. I can't sort of remember the moment particularly, but next thing I knew, from the floor, she'd kind of like sort of karate kicked out, and then my leg was just sort of planted, and it just kind of went inward. The real sort of a bit like a sort of footballer's injury, you know,
right,
you can get sort of hammered from the side. And
straight away, their own strength though. Sometimes
I mean, I sort of felt for her. She was mortified.
Yeah, but
she was just sort of went into a heap, saying, "I killed Dad." And I'm like, "No, come here." And I sort of first thing I did was just got her to come and sit next to me, put my arm around her, and
Were you mid-tour at that point or anything?
No, well, I was just about to do a final run of solo shows. I guess it was about 2 months' worth of gigs, some over in Europe as well. Mm-hmm. Some great ones I booked over in, like, Italy and Spain, which I was really excited about and been for years.
Just going on in a wheelchair.
I think in essence, yeah, I could play a show like that, but it's everything in between, all the
traveling
and getting on a plane
no.
and going through airports. And I'd rather not be ferried around on one of those sort of airport carts.
It's not the best look.
No,
it,
really? Not really. But it was bonkers, you know. It's just the first time I'd ever broken a bone in my life. So it was the weirdest feeling when it happened as well. I knew that when I sort of stood up, there was like nothing there. And it's just such a strange sensation.
Yeah.
And it didn't really hurt. It wasn't, there was not really pain. It was just...
Well, probably your adrenaline was up from the play fight anyway.
Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah.
It probably helped.
Exactly. No, it's just that it was more the kind of, the sort of realisation that, right, it's Friday night, I've got to go to A&E. That was what pissed me off the most, actually.
Yeah.
Just, having to go and do that. But... I mean, you know, it was. They were amazing. I went to the Radcliffe at John Radcliffe in Oxford, and they were just incredible. Our wonderful NHS. They were sort of. It was quite overwhelming, actually.
Yeah, but
how brilliantly I was looked after, and
well, we need to appreciate them, don't we?
Yeah, and just how diverse everybody who was working, who was dealing with me, all the backgrounds and the different cultures, and it was just a kind of beautiful thing to see, you know, just kind of firsthand, if you like. You don't sometimes realise how beautifully it works until you're unfortunately, kind of in the middle of it. Yeah.
So in a way, because that break that forced you to take that time off, didn't it? Really, because you couldn't be doing that tour.
No.
Are you quite good at switching off and not working, taking off your sort of creative head and putting on your family head, not and focusing on that?
Not particularly. I mean, it can be kind of tricky to sort of compartmentalise and just sort of separate things when I'm in the middle of them.
Hmm.
But it was kind of easier because I knew that it was like, right, yeah, you're out for sort of 5-6 months. So, you know, I quickly realised that I just needed to sort of put it into some writing.
I was going to say, did you do a lot of writing during that time?
Not as much as I would have liked to. Probably hammered more box sets than anything, really. Just the sort of early days of...
Needs must, guys. You've got to go with it.
You know, getting through Line of Duty and...
I highly recommend that.
But, no, it was... it was kind of... I guess it was sort of... I enjoyed being able to completely switch off, actually, for a little bit, yeah.
That's kind of healthy, though, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think, because normally there just isn't that excuse to or the opportunity to fully switch off when you've got no choice. So that was... the first month or so was all right, and then it just got more frustrating and, like, I really wanted to
get back out there,
hammer through some ideas and do some writing, which I did, you know, I did in the end, and then I brought a track out about a month ago.
Which is Salamander.
Yeah. So that was kind of... that was the result of some sessions I'd done with the band, and that was
a nice great. Back playing festivals.
Mm. Yeah, it's been great actually. There's been some crackers recently. Yeah. I mean, it's just brilliant to play with the band I've got there. They're so great. They're so infectious and enthusiastic and just such brilliant players. It's a joy.
And has that been the same band since when you started the first album?
It's kind of evolved over the years, yeah. A few of the guys have been in from pretty much near the beginning, but it's kind of evolved over the years. But yeah, it's a great setup.
But now you've got it all perfect.
Yes, just in time for it all to stop for a bit. So I've kind of finished touring for the year and back into the studio writing and a few other kind of exciting things that are on the way. Maybe for next year, yeah.
But you're still not stopping. Even on the nose touring.
No, exactly. It's just sort of back into the studio.
Is that always usually the yearly routine that this happens and the summertime forces you to get out and then you go back into the studio? Do you have the control to sort of switch it up?
Yeah, kind of. There's a sort of like internal clock that sort of, I just know when I'm done touring for a bit. And equally, like, you know, I know when I'm sort of, when I've had enough of... working on the same songs in the studio over and over again. You kind of just something tells me that it's time to shift the setting and the approach, you know.
How are you touring? Do you enjoy it or do you...
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, it feels great. I mean, there's not particularly much to kind of adapt to as far as like age and stuff. It's all pretty much, you know... Like, you know, the energy levels are still high and it's just, you just sort of attack it, you know, and once you're on the road, I just find that I get quite single-minded about it and quite sort of focused. And it feels great. It feels really good. Yeah, I mean, maybe you have to kind of watch out for a little bit of kind of over-partying when you get excited and, you know,
of course,
on tour or something.
You've got all that adrenaline and you need to sort of channel it in a certain way.
And when you're working with great people as well, you know, people that you really love and that you get on really well with, it's easy to get carried away and just, you know, do a great show and then you kind of have a big night. But you have to sort of ease up on that a little bit at times.
And also... You know, you get to a certain age and you go, I can't be doing that stuff anymore.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly.
Do you know when you're in the studio and you're writing, you were talking then and you go over a song and you go over a song, do you get to a point where, no, I'm happy with that, that's finished, or does it ever end? Or are you a perfectionist in that respect?
I think there's always this sort of natural point where it feels like I'm pretty much there. And it's usually when the final vocal goes on. Mm. I know that there's going to be a few elements that are left to kind of tidy up or to rearrange or to kind of maybe edit. But yeah, between myself and Ian Davenport, who I worked with on the last two records, I think, you know, we kind of know when it's time to let it go.
Yeah.
And I always find that the mastering is kind of always quite key, because I kind of mix a lot myself as well. And I kind of, I don't know, I like to mix because I think it's all kind of an ongoing process, and some of the moves and the balances that I've got over time have been there since the beginning of the recording. It's kind of like a kind of constant mixing process. So unlike the old days where you'd sort of have a mixing session at the end of the recording. So I find that sort of mastering's great, because you just sort of send it to somebody I trust and they kind of tidy up all the kind of shit sonic bits that I didn't spot, because I'm kind of not hugely technical, you know, so you just sort of find ways of making it work, yeah.
And are there huge changes from certainly recording with a band to being a solo artist?
Yeah, I think just the sort of freedom to experiment. It depends, you know, if you're in a band that it's all firing and everyone's on the same page, I think that, you know, there can be nothing more exciting and liberating, you know, working together with people to kind of get to a magical point.
Yeah.
But equally, if it's not firing, it can be really frustrating and kind of like, you know, can feel like you're trying to get Theresa May's Brexit deal through. You know, it's, I don't know, it's just like, well, feels
relentless. Would there be less battles?
Yeah, and less battles, I guess, but just the sort of freedom to explore and experiment without people being bored in the room next to me, you know, or, you know, which again, it sort of, you know, can work on the flip side. But I enjoy working on ideas that are a bit bonkers or have a strange starting point. And I think, yeah, I think if there are other people with me, I think they may not kind of see what I'm seeing,
yeah,
or what I'm trying to get.
And also, you've probably got to keep exciting yourself and being inspired.
Yeah.
And if your taste is different to somebody else, and then...
Yeah, there's a lot gets lost in the sort of trying to translate an idea as well. It's hard to explain, you know, what you're trying to get from an idea or a part or a sound. Sometimes it just takes a couple of hours of getting really, you know, crap sounds and
thrashing it out.
You know, not working until you get to a point where you sort of come full circle and find a way around.
It's kind of it for loads of things, though, isn't it? If you keep trying and failing and failing and failing, and then you actually get there in the end.
Yeah.
It could be whatever, really.
Kind of if you've got the energy to do that to yourself, which, which I sort of have, I think. Yeah. I'm quite happy to get lost in frustration and you know, being worried about failing. You know, I think all those sort of things. I think it just makes it what it is when you finally get there.
And it's kind of part of the creative process with anything, really, isn't it? Mm. It's always that same path, and sometimes it's hard to express exactly what you mean.
Yeah.
Or exactly what you want.
Yeah. Yeah, I just find you've got to get as close to that initial thing that was in my head. You know, I don't know. Yeah. But it's kind of like when you sort of, you know, when you're a young band and you sort of rip someone off a little bit and you try, you know, you don't mean to.
But you've been so inspired by them, it's going to...
And you sort of rip them off and you realise that actually even when you've ripped them off, it doesn't sound anything like them. Because it's like your version of trying to sort of do something. And, you know, you can never do it like Hendrix did it or like Dylan did it. So you just sort of... And it's a bit like that, sort of almost like kind of trying to work out what you want yourself. It's kind of like ripping off yourself. It's like, right, I've got this beat, this something in my head, this beat and this bass line and this kind of mellotron part, and I can hear it, but... And so then you just explore and go round and round until you get something. And, yeah, so to be able to do that on my own is a kind of very liberating process, yeah.
Guys, can we talk about growing up?
Let's.
So, born here... In Oxford,
yes,
right?
Born in Oxford, yeah.
And then, did you stay here for long?
No, probably like a couple of years in Oxford, and then my dad got a job over in America, in California, in like 78, I think 79.
So you were what?
I was three.
Three.
I think, yeah, three when we moved over there.
Is it just you, Gaz? Your mum, dad, you?
No, I've got three other brothers.
Three other brothers?
Yeah, so there's four boys, yeah.
Right.
So I'm sort of in the middle. There's one younger and two older. Yeah, so moved over there for like 3 years, 79 to 82, I think.
So did you start school over in...
I was just like kind of, you know, nursery, I guess.
Yeah.
I really remember an awful an awful lot, but just, I guess I remember the kind of the lifestyle, and, you know, as you would if, you know, as a young kid, the kind of, you know, the boiling hot pavements on bare feet and kind of hot rain and swimming pools and...
Don't get that much over here, do we?
Bob's Big Boy diner and stuff. Yeah, no. You know, it was sort of, yeah, definitely... It really stayed with me. I mean, I think it probably also because when we came back to the UK in 82, we'd still keep going back to the States to...
Oh, did you?
To kind of have holidays, and my dad sort of...
There was still a connection there.
There was still a lot of connections and stuff. So it just, yeah, became a massive part of those early years, you know, just sort of life over there. And so every time I go back, there's a sense of sort of kind of a, you know, a kind of a home... You know, from the beginning, yeah, kind of a
feeling of the
beginnings. Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah, kind of most. Yeah, I've been back on every record to tour and stuff, which has been brilliant. It's always amazing. The last one I did was great. It was actually just a solo tour, just on my own with some guitars and drum machines and piano and stuff.
How did you find that? Is that quite liberating just to be out there by yourself?
Yeah, it was actually. It's sort of. It kind of taught me quite a lot, actually, just about how to deal with gigs in a different way when there's not the kind of the safety net of like, I guess, a big band, sort of also a big crowd, and the ease to be reliant on hits, you know, to pick up the set when you want it. It was all very sort of quite exposing, and, you know.
That's kind of scary. It's quite nice to be scared, though.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think it also sort of helped with just being able to speak to the audience a lot more, you know.
Because of the intimate spaces.
Yeah, maybe a little bit of kind of fight or flight in terms of, you know, I can't just stand here and in between songs just do nothing and then move to the next one. You can't, you know. And I was, because I was never really a big talker on stage in Supergrass. It was kind of, I didn't really have time, to be honest. I was kind of,
no,
just all those kind of 2.5 minute punk songs and you just...
Just straight through.
Whiz into the next one, yeah. But
are you getting better now at talking to the crowd?
I think just in feeling like at home, you know, on stage, I think. And you know, I mean, there's never particularly huge amounts of stage fright or anything, but definitely as a kid, you know, I would kind of, it would feel kind of otherworldly. Mm. You know, I look back at some Glastonbury performance in 97, I think it was. Or maybe it was 95, it might have been our first one. And it was just the other day, so it just came up online. And it was insane to see it, because it was that kind of people going on for miles, as far as you could see.
Yeah.
And all going nuts to All Right. And I can't really remember it.
I bet it's just a
blur. I think it might have been a bit, yeah, sort of walk on, you go, fuck, look at that.
God, what that lot.
Right. Count us in, Danny. 1, 2, 3, 4. And then it's just... And then you walk off stage. A bit like a kind of, you know, out-of-body experience. So it's kind of, I guess, maybe just having the space in my head more to appreciate it and soak it up and just to sort of know where I am. Well, that's kind of been really cool, actually, just to... Because there's been some big shows for me over the last few years as well. Doing, you know, even playing the headline in the Palladium in London, which was a real highlight. From last year, and Glastonbury Park stage in 2015 was another big one for me and my solo stuff, and you know, they were just sort of it felt really good to actually feel the moment properly, yeah.
Because I was talking to a musician last year, and she was saying when I'm performing the songs, absolutely in my element. When the song stops, and she feels that she has to get some sort of dialogue with the audience, she just goes really internal, and she can't handle it. But she said slowly, she is getting better.
Yeah.
But when she's performing and she's singing, she's a warrior.
But it's weird. It sort of depends on what sort of mood you go. I find it's what mood I go on stage in. is it really affects everything. Do you have not that I ever go on in a bad... Well, you know, I have done, I guess. But
no, but then again, we all have good days and bad days.
Yeah, exactly. So it's more how your sort of personal headspace creeps into the show. Because, yeah, you know, play, once you hit the song, you know, regardless of how I'm feeling, I can deliver it with the same sort of emotion and sort of focus. But, but yeah, I see that. I get some gigs where the song ends and I just don't really feel like talking to anyone. So I just sort of wink at one of the band and go, "Come on, let's start it." You know, I don't know. And it's not, I'm not being antisocial. I just I don't want to say anything right now. But then, you know, yeah, other shows where you can't shut me up, I guess. You know. It just depends.
And how was school life when you got back here?
Kind of went to a few different ones.
What from moving around?
No, actually, no. We sort of moved back to the same village we'd left originally.
Mm.
I don't know what it was. My mum was she used to be an English teacher when she was younger. I guess there was a sort of real focus on doing the right thing for us academically. But it was a strange sort of time for me in a way, because both my older brothers had done, you know, really amazingly well, like ridiculously well at GCSEs and A-levels. Like my older brother Rob got 10 A's at GCSE and sort of made the local paper and shit.
All right, show off, Rob.
You know what I mean? And I had to deal with the fallout of that, like, you know, sort of 4 years younger, just starting off at secondary or edging into secondary. And
were you quite academic or...?
No, not really. Not at all? No, no. And it's, well, I mean, you know, English and it was sort of more English and art, really, were my things, and music. And then music took over about 11, 12 years old. We started playing at school in the drama studio and trying to, you know, put on gigs for our mates.
Where did that come from, the music? Was that always just within you, or was it passed down from somewhere?
I think it was definitely the environment, I think, growing up at sort of parties and Christmases and sort of Easter gatherings and stuff. My uncles were very musical and, you know, bring down acoustic guitars. And we'd sort of have little jams and play old sort of Eddie Cochran songs, and it was that was always a real laugh at these kind of big gatherings. And my uncle left his record collection at my place at my mum's house. I guess must have been about 10, 11 years old, and it was a massive record collection. And I was told never to go down to the basement to mess with them,
right.
Because of course every night I went down and started just kind of flipping through them and just found, just all this incredible music, you know, Sex Pistols and Blondie and Patti Smith and J.J. Cale and Neil Young and Dylan and you know, Bowie, and it just sort of went on and on. It was like
all the great stuff for a musical education, right?
Yeah, basically, yeah. And it was like kind of discovering a new language or something. It was like, I can't stress enough how much it changed everything, just sort of, because, you know, at the same time, I guess what was this was like sort of, you know, 86 87, and you know I was buying you know, Mr. Kyrie on 7-inch at the local solo supermarket and stuff like that. You know, I was doing that sort of shit into the charts or whatever. But then that's when things like the Smiths and the Cure and Susie the Banshees started coming in, and sort of you know, then Spaceman 3 and the Pixies and Dinosaur Jr. and stuff. So it was kind of, that was a really, I think, probably, you know, 11 to 13, 14 was when I sort of discovered the you know, the fundamental, you know, great bands.
And when you were sort of in your drama room with your band and you were sort of doing these gigs at school, were you doing the covers that were inspiring you, or were you sort of writing your own stuff?
Yeah, it was mainly covers. I guess we do some Cure stuff. We did a bit of Smiths, and we used to play Freak Scene by Dinosaur Jr., which was one of our favourites.
Right.
And our songs were kind of... I don't know, they were sort of songs we had, like, The Girl with the Removable Face.
That was a title.
That was a title,
That title.
And and she just used to sort of pull it off and use it as a frisbee and stuff, and all the things that she could do with her removable face. It's a sad story, because she didn't have much of a life. But
I don't know why I'm laughing.
Yeah, so no, sad. It's really, yeah, no, but I think she won out in the end. And then sort of, I don't know, what else do we have? You Keep Punching Me, which is like a sort of punk song just about getting sort of beat up all the time. But it was a good song, actually. I could imagine sort of slaves doing it now, actually, you know. But
sell it to them?
Yeah.
They need a hit.
Yeah. And so we were sort of flirting with songwriting.
Yeah.
And there were some fun ones, yeah.
Did you think at that point, when you were that young, no, this could be a career for me?
No, I don't think so. Not. Well, you know, maybe when I hit kind of 14, 15 with the Jennifers, which was our first sort of proper band, I guess, there was sort of little hints around that time. And it was kind of ridiculous. We got signed to Nude Records.
At what age?
I was 15
Jesus,
when that happened.
Yeah, so my mum, that young.
Yeah, my mum had to sign that deal for me after a gig. It's quite mental. I remember it quite clearly. It was a gig in Oxford, and they sort of set up this big table after the show, and all the crowd had gone, and sort of this big table that my mum was sat at with these kind of bits of paperwork, sort of looking through them with their glasses on.
Yeah,
quite bizarre.
Had they come to see you, or did you know?
Yeah, we knew that was going to happen as well.
You knew it was happening,
yeah.
Right?
And
that was a lot of pressure for a 15-year-old knowing that the record company.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was only two. It was like a two-single deal, which is a bizarre deal to sort of get. But you know,
does things like that still happen now?
I don't think so. I doubt it. I mean, you can get sort of like production deals, you know, like development deals and stuff. Maybe it was a kind of form of a development deal, but yeah, it was like, look, give us two singles and we'll take it from there.
A bit like in the television industry where they would do you. Development deal and then we'll see.
Okay, yeah.
Then we'll see what happens. Yeah. And then, all right, write me episode one.
You do a pilot or something, yeah.
I do a pilot and then we'll see. Yeah,
totally. So it's kind of, that was quite a big thing for us, I think, you know. And
how did the singles go down?
It was all right.
Yeah.
You know, I think it was good. I remember hearing it first time on the radio. We were at the, I think it was a Joiners in Southampton. And we'd done a sound check and we'd gone to get some food at this little cafe. And back today, came on the radio. And
that must have been such a feeling.
Yeah, it was insane. It was bonkers. We didn't hide it. We were just like legging it around the cafe, just going, it's us!
No, Shuddy, you were 15. No, what an absolute I'm buzz. That's like a dream for people.
Yeah, no, it was bonkers.
It's still quite nice now, though, even when you switch on the radio and something comes on.
Yeah.
Of course.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, no. I mean, I listen to the radio.
You don't take it for granted,
I suppose. I listen to the radio all the time, and it's not like I'm always hearing my stuff. You know, it's kind of, when it comes on, it's kind of interesting because I can sort of listen to it a bit more sort of subjectively.
I was going to say...
You know, I don't listen to it as my sort of song, in a way. I kind of...
Because I find it really hard... If ever,
yeah. What's
I
that?
Pop up,
what, yeah.
I don't, well, don't. I just switch off.
Do you?
I find it, I can't.
Really? Don't you feel proud of a scene or something? Like you just think,
great. No, never happy. Never happy.
Really?
No. But, yeah. I always think, well, you know, could have done better. So yeah, that's why I stopped because I think it wasn't doing me any good for my work. Do you ever do that? Do you listen to one of your songs and go, actually, in retrospect, we should have changed that? Or
not really. It's maybe more... I get what you're saying, actually. Maybe with sort of gigs and TV performances, I get sent them, and I don't watch them. I think it's a bit of a weird one. It's partly because there's nothing I can do. It's gone. It's gone
exactly,
out.
Yeah.
And I just want to... If I remember it as being great fun, like when we did Jules Holland and we did James Corden over in America, actually, last year, which was insane. And that was just such a vibey performance. I didn't really want to watch it back because I knew that I'd see something and it would ruin my sort of memory of it being such a vibey performance.
Exactly. It was at that time and where you were feeling it. And you can still recall that feeling.
Yeah.
Whereas
totally.
If you watch it, it's like stepping out of yourself.
Exactly. But the only thing I don't want to miss is kind of watching it, I could see where there could be improvements for next time or something. You know what I mean? I know there's moments where you're saying
and there's a for and against that as well, even from my side. And there's some people that do it and some people that don't.
But the guys in the band are great for that because they will watch everything and stuff.
Right.
So I'll get a little text from Nick or from Garrow just sort of saying, man, that performance was amazing. Or like, you know, next time we do it, should we look at, you know, bringing the guitar in a bit earlier? You know, there are cool little comments I get from the guys. Yeah,
they are helpful though. If you've got somebody else watching your back and you can change it and tweak,
yeah,
and hone the performances, that can only be a positive thing.
No, exactly.
I suppose it's when you look at it and you all you can see is the bad things, and then it becomes negative.
Yeah,
and it's like it can be destructive. Yeah, I suppose.
Yeah, no, exactly.
If you get it to that level,
right.
So what happened with the Jennifers? When did that sort of...
Yeah, well, I think it's sort of petered out a bit, really, because we did all right on that first sort of single. And then it was time to kind of provide them with another one. I don't know, we tried and we got some tracks together, but I think it was really what they wanted. They were quite open about it and just sort of said, no, maybe this isn't quite right. Maybe kind of go listen to some more Mad Records and come back and, I don't know, just get some inspiration for something new.
Yeah.
And
also, you're very young at the time as well, yeah, weren't you? So you're all growing up and working out who you are as a person, let alone an artist.
Yeah, and it was still, ultimately, it was just the school band. It was a school band. So I think it just sort of naturally kind of sort of quietened down, and then we kind of morphed a bit into Supergrass and kind of met Mick. I'd known Mick around the village because we lived in the same village. But
was the time period from sort of that disbanding to the slow sort of form of Supergrass?
I don't think it was very long. I think it was probably within a year. You know, just I mean, it was also the sort of, there was a bit of a scene around Oxford because we were hanging around a lot with Tara Milton, who was in a band called 5:30 as well,
right,
and the New Bars and with Sam Williams as well, who produced the first Supergrass record. We'd sort of met up with him as well. So there was this bit of a kind of a vibe sort of going around with musicians, and so we'd kind of jam with each other a little bit. And then, just through, I don't know, it was probably, a year or so from Jennifer's splitting. Then I was working with Mick in the Harvester restaurant in Wheatley.
Were you on the salad bar?
Never got that far.
Never got up the salad bar.
If only.
It's where we all aspire to be.
I know, it's my dream.
You know?
All of those kind of... Yeah. There was some serious kind of hierarchy issues at the Harvester. There was some big-time bullying going on. I mean, I was a KP, you know? I was just in the kitchen kind of clearing up the shit. And then all the kind of hot waiters and waitresses were kind of swanning in, just dumping plates at me and stuff. But we just waited for them all to leave, and then we tidy up at the end and put loads of loud music on the ghetto blaster in the kitchen, and have a bit of a smoke outside, and then mop the floors really stoned, and it kind of helped to get through. And then we talk about music. Maybe we just talk about music a lot and stuff that we're into, and then we go back to his after the shift and just mess around on acoustics. And so that was the kind of beginnings of something. And obviously I'd known Danny and played with Danny for a few years, so...
Did you meet Danny at school?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's about sort of, I guess I was 12, he was a year above me, maybe two years above me, I can't remember, yeah.
Right.
So
you were already friends from that?
Yeah, exactly. So it was kind of like, I think we were carrying on sort of playing music together, and then Mick came along and it just felt like this cool little three-piece thing.
And did you start initially writing together or individually and then bring in the parts?
No, we would just write together, because we'd just go to go to one of our houses and just set up and just play, really. And it was interesting, actually, because there was nothing based on covers particularly. It was all
fresh.
It was all about
material.
Kind of what can we write. And very early on, it was kind of strange. It wasn't like those first tracks. There was sort of, I don't know, there were kind of other elements in it that weren't quite right yet, sort of a bit too, possibly, maybe a bit too funky in places. Or so. I think all new young bands kind of have a little bit of a time where they're a bit too funky.
Yeah.
And you need to dumb it down a bit. And look, all right, okay, look, it's fun to play something syncopated and a bit funky. Yeah, it's a laugh, but it doesn't mean that everyone's going to enjoy hearing it.
No.
Dumb it down a bit, just kind of take it back to something more raw and.
And also, the age that you were then, what was this?
This is probably sort of 92.
Right.
93. So, yeah, it's like sort of 16. And, just the records that we were listening to as well, just such mad records that we listened to. Just
what were you listening to? So diverse. At that time?
I mean, I don't know, anything from kind of, Zappa and Beefheart to the Muppets.
Right.
And, Cheech and Chong, and sort of quite a lot of comedy record, like comedy music records, yeah. Which is quite mad. Which there used to be loads of all the time.
Yeah, there used to be.
And then the Beatles, obviously.
Yeah.
And Hendrix and stuff, and Neil Young, really, and it was
God, that kind of says a lot for that first album. All those stuff that you were listening to.
Yeah,
the Muppets and Zappa and Beefheart.
Yeah, and I think that's where the sort of also that's kind of where. I don't know, we never really, from day one, we didn't really take ourselves too seriously. I think we were, I guess we'd come through the 80s and there's quite a lot of, earnest, kind of pompous kind of music going on and how it's presented and
how it's
seeing bands in interviews.
The world
And then, we always loved watching those Beatles interviews where they would just sort of take the piss and kind of give random answers that was silly.
So it was quite a conscious
sort of messing
thing
around.
Then, just to not take it as serious, or certainly not take yourselves too seriously.
Yeah, definitely. I think, I think that was where we always found a kind of interesting balance, because I think when we got into the studio, when we had that four-track recorder, cassette recorder set up in the living room, it was a serious thing.
Yeah.
It was like, I guess, elements of the process and the journey to what we'd record were fun, and there were always moments of surrealness and odd decisions, but we take it seriously, the end result, but also maybe letting stuff creep into the lyrics that would give more of a vibe of our character and our personalities that we got up to, just being three boys in a village just sort of dicking around and getting into trouble and
but that really came across, didn't it? Sometimes in a band you can see the people, but you can't really see the personalities. And I thought something that was immediate.
I think that's one that frustrates me a lot. Knowing when I know people and what they're like, artists or whatever, and then you hear the music and the lyrics, and there's nothing. It just becomes quite sort of generic and sort of rock lyric-y. And if for some reason it's kind of like, but when I talk to you, you're hilarious, or you just
put
all these great,
these
insightful kind of funny little comebacks and stuff, and you just think, yeah, get some of that in.
It's funny that, isn't it? Because sometimes when you listen to certain artists and you go, I'm listening to this song and I know this cost you a lot, this comes from a right old bit of heartache or something that you've been through, and then you can listen to something else and you go, this is nothing. It might as well just be white noise. It doesn't mean anything. It doesn't connect with you, so it's certainly not going to connect with me.
Yeah. And it's it is a hard one. It's kind of, it's subjective, and it's, it's not like, you always have to kind of, bleed onto record or whatever. But it's, I think, just some directness in terms of, lyrics and how one could not take oneself too seriously at times and just play with it.
Do you still feel that now, to take the work seriously but not yourself too seriously, or do you think things have morphed?
I do feel this sort of in my DNA, I guess. I mean, there's sort of, it's been, interesting for me to explore, stuff that feels kind of personal to me on these records. I mean, I guess they're sort of solo records. They're from my mind.
Yeah.
So,
there
are going to be questions.
So
there are going to be questions, and there are going to be kind of intense kind of personal moments, which I'm fine about. In fact, it was kind of, that was quite liberating as well, to realise that it's okay to just be really quite brutally honest in a song.
Do you think there was a time when you weren't honest?
I think there were times maybe when we write by committee on lyrics, which got a little bit cloudy, but it was cool because we were always, from day one, we would write together lyrics as well, which was you know, other people can find quite strange sort of notion. But
did that because seem to gel quite easily? The three of you
Well,
together?
Because we were just sort of, it was like we were sort of brothers, just sort of growing up. So we were doing everything together. So if one of us started writing about a girl, you know, the others were aware of that girl and or whatever it was. You know, we could all sort of have some input in whatever idea came along. I mean, Caught by the Fuzz. Although there was only me involved in that night where
I got
arrested. But I was on my way to Danny's and I was with friends that were all of our friends. So
there is a link.
Yeah, so when we came to wrote that, we wrote that all together. You know, that was a kind of a collaborative thing. And that was really cool. I think that was what worked brilliantly with the lyrics early on especially, and equally, you know, through our career at different times. But yeah, there were definitely times where it was like pulling teeth, definitely, yeah, trying to write lyrics, the sort of three of us together.
But when you say sometimes writing by committee, was that the label bosses sort of, or
no, it was just us, you know? That was just, it was just an extension of how we started. So through every, you know, even on Diamond Hoo-Ha, which is our last studio album, there was still a kind of similar approach to writing.
Yeah.
Maybe a bit more kind of separate demos because technology and, you know, a few of us had sort of, you know, 4-track record, 8-track recorders or whatever by that point, or even computers actually by that point. But little subtle changes here and there. But yeah. the sort of essence was the same, yeah.
Because certainly I think the videos were such a big thing, I think, throughout the Supergrass years. Mm. And especially the early ones, they had such a definite style. We talked about people's characters coming across before, and they always really pinged out in those videos. Was that something that all three of you consciously had input into and something that you wanted to do?
Yeah, well, and also because we had Nick Goffey and Dom Hawley, who were friends of ours, doing the videos.
Yeah.
So they were, I mean, Nick's Danny's brother. So that was kind of like the band thing in terms of us all understanding where each other's coming from, or you know, knowing the context of a lyric. It's the same with the videos. We understood immediately the context that Nick or Dom was presenting this idea to us.
Yeah.
So that was kind of easy. You know, that was easy in a way. It was like a big gang. You know, the three of us, and then Nick and Dom just kind of creating something mad and visual. And we were lucky, it was a good time. Well, I say a good time, it was a sort of healthy time financially in music, in the industry, so that you would, you know, you'd get big
budgets
for the videos and stuff. So it just meant you could, you know, explore these mad ideas without too much worry. And
were you given the freedom to do that?
Yeah, definitely.
Has that changed a lot throughout the years?
Oh yeah, completely. Yeah. No, there's. If you're a huge band, if you're a huge artist on a major label, there's obviously still the money to make big videos. But I think,
our videos,
the level that we were at the beginning. No, if that was now, there'd be kind of nothing really.
But music videos aren't as much of a thing.
And the culture as well. Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, it was like a kind of. Yeah, it was a big time for music videos. It was like kind of. It's like 1981 all over again with MTV or whatever, whenever it kind of came out. But yeah, that sort of, you know, that real freshness around music videos and just ideas and having something fun and cinematic and you know, adventurous.
Because there used to be that time when, oh, it's the big new music video from X, Y, and Z, whoever it was, and that would be shown, and it was a chance show, but we don't have those programs.
No, I know, it's true. I mean, they were good barometers. I mean, it was Top of the Pops was the perfect barometer, really, for sort of kind of however you perceive success. I always felt that if, you know, the first time we were on Top of the Pops, it was like, I called my mum, and it's like, we've done it, we've made it. It's like, that's it, simple.
But,
there's no other particular kind of barometer for if we've made it. Whereas now, now it's there's so many angles you can come at it from, and you can also build up your fan base over time, you know, online and through social media, and it's kind of there's tons of angles you can hit it from these days. But yeah, it was kind of, you know, I mean, nothing's better or worse. It just was changed, interesting. Yeah. It's quite sort of charming, and it's quite interesting to look back at things like that and think, yeah, it's a very simple realization. But you know, even I remember feeling. I just often feel really lucky that we were, I guess, part of the end of an enormous sort of period of time in music where people would record to tape, you know, and that was the only thing that was available. And in 95, it still was. That was the only thing you could record on. There were no computers. So it's kind of, I sort of look back at that and feel kind of lucky that yeah, we were on the very, very tail end of how music was being made in, you know, the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. Yeah. The same way, same approach. Yeah, so that's kind of cool. But yeah, no, I never particularly sort of, it's not like a, I particularly miss it. It's just, again, it's just an interesting kind of side note.
Yeah, and you were there and you had that
yeah,
time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I've got to ask you how true...
Is
that you?
That's not me.
That's unbelievable. Really? That's terrible.
I was just so excited Get him to out start of here. Talking.
Whose phone's that? Are you, Julie?
Alex, it is me.
No. Oh, unbelievable. Look, we're having a right old good natter here, guys, and you're leaving your phone on. Terrible.
Look, it's my daughter. No, it's fine. I'll deal with it later. Right.
Tell me how true.
Tell me everything.
If true, is the Spielberg story.
Yeah, man.
Because I remember hearing about it at the time, and I didn't know if it was sort of whispers or not.
Yeah, it was true. It was,
please tell me the Spielberg story.
It was bonkers, actually. I mean, it was... I can't exactly remember how it came about. It was in between the first two records, that's for sure. So All Right had been out, video had been out, had that big summer of 95, and I think it was the following spring, just got this random call from Spielberg's people. Julie will probably, Julie's over there, she'll probably remember it better than I do how it all came about. But yeah, we just got a call or an email or whatever, and just said, just, yeah, Stephen would be interested in meeting the band. I think it's his kids were like a big fan of the video, All Right video. We were just talking about the importance of videos and stuff. I think his kids had seen it. For all I know, they'd seen it and said, Daddy, I want that band. So, you know, get me that band. So I don't know how it came about, but yeah, it was bonkers. So we heard about it and we all sort of thought it was hilarious.
Because he wanted to do sort of a Monkees style TV show? Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how particularly how... Well, yeah, because the weird thing was that we kind of thought it was a bit of a... Not a joke, but just one of those things that would go away. And then they got back in touch for us to go over there to meet him at Universal Studios. It was kind of like, right, he wants us to go over. So we just thought, yeah, well, look, we've got to go over and meet him. Whether we're going to do it or not, we probably had a hunch that we wouldn't do something like that. But we wanted to hear what the deal was. And it wasn't like a Monkees... Well, I guess it kind of was, but it was... it wasn't really mentioned too much, that as a kind of template. But, it was a TV show based on a band, living together. Sounds like the Monkees, doesn't
sounds
it?
Sounds like Monkees. Bit of music, bit of comedy. Yeah, yeah. It's Monkees, guys.
Yeah, I'm not going to kid myself anymore. All right. So, yeah, we were supposed to do Monkees. But it was, do you know what? It was amazing. We sat down at this big table with him and his PA and a few other people. And I was sat next to him, actually, and I had a little moment before the start of the meeting just to say hello and chat about a few things. And within sort of seconds, somehow we moved on to Twilight Zone.
Right.
I think because I was watching loads of Twilight Zone at that point, all the black and white ones. I just got really, really into them. So we had this great little chat about Twilight Zone and different episodes and, you know, the episode where the guy's the last man on earth and he wants to read. That's all he wants to do is read books. And then his glasses fall off and break and he can't find, you know. And then, you know, the watch that stops and then freezes time. So we had this brilliant little chat about our favourite Twilight Zone episodes.
What is your favourite Twilight Zone episode? Off the top of your head?
Probably... I don't know. You said, well, probably there's an 80s version. There's one with John Lithgow in the with the terror at 30,000 feet, whatever.
I think
the probably the one where his glasses fall off, where he's the... I had all the time I needed. Well, I can't remember what the line was.
I can't remember what the time was, but I've got that image in my head.
I had so much time. But anyway, yeah.
But the one I remember that really sticks in my mind that really freaked me out, and for some reason I think it was William Shatner, and I'm not sure if it was, but it's about the guy that gets on a plane. And
he's by the window seat. Exactly, yeah.
And there's a storm in there, and he keeps looking out, and there's the little gremlin who's literally taking the part of the wing aside.
It's amazing.
And he slowly loses his shit on this plane.
It is incredible.
It's amazing.
So have you seen the 80s version of that?
With John Lithgow?
No. Yeah. It's brilliant. Well, it's called Twilight Zone, the movie. That period of time in the 80s where everything was like, you know...
The movie.
Santa Claus, the movie.
Creepshow, the movie, yeah.
So it was that, Twilight Zone. And it was, I don't know if Spielberg directed one, or there was a few big directors, but there was like three short films to make up this movie.
I do remember it because I saw it on Betamax.
I know, and then Dan Aykroyd's in the first one where they're driving along and Dan Aykroyd goes, do you want to see something really scary?
Yes, I did. What a brilliant opening. I do remember it.
And I watched that first. I probably first watched it when I was about seven, and it just utterly destroyed it. Freaked me out.
Yeah.
I just was obsessed with it. So anyway, I don't know, maybe I was desperate to speak to him about that for some reason.
So you're having a big Twilight Zone chat
in
Spielberg's office, and then...
Yeah, and then it was just pretty general chit-chat, really, and they mentioned about the possibility of doing a pilot for a TV show where we're all kind of musicians in a house, and I can't particularly remember the conversation too well, but...
But you obviously were all in agreement that you were
really
going to do it.
We knew straight away, pretty much. I mean, we were already working on In It For The Money... the beginnings of the second album.
Right.
Which actually wasn't yet called In It For The Money. And I think a lot of these things that have happened to us kind of paved the way for that title to come about. But in a obviously ironic way. So we just knew that it wasn't... You know, I think it was just that idea of fast-tracking through America by, you know... doing something that kind of takes you right up there, you know, kind of quickly up, you know, the fame stakes and whatever. And I just think we knew that it wasn't right for us.
Yeah.
You know, we had a lot to do. We was just, you know, off the back of Ashikoko, it was, you know, it was amazing. We were at a really, a great point, you know, and a great place.
At a great time.
At a great time. And I don't think we wanted to sort of disturb that. And just, you know, we weren't, you know, we were pretty clued up in terms of how it could work out. Basically, it was one of us sort of ODing in a hotel room, maybe. I don't know. I don't know, but it just felt weird, like it might all go a bit tits up.
Yeah. I suppose if you get thrust into that spotlight too quickly.
Yeah. But, you know, definitely just the pull of the second record was really strong for us, I think. So I don't know if people look at that and think it was a ridiculous decision, but we felt that it was really important.
I don't think they would, because you were on quite a natural progression from the first album, and it was only going to be going like that. So to veer off to the right on something that was... kind of completely different that you hadn't done. I don't know. I'm kind of in your camp. I think you made the right decision.
Well, it was perfectly in tune with with our slightly self-destructive kind of ways in terms of like our career.
Yeah.
I don't know, actually, maybe self-destructive is the wrong word, but just...
you never came across
taking sort of left, but just sort of taking left weird turns when you could take a sort of... take an easy, fast, you know, route, we'd kind of go somewhere different. And I think the fact we didn't make another... The second album wasn't like Ashikoko and we didn't do All Right Again and things like that. It was a very different record.
But I suppose...
So not self... Not even, maybe sort of self-sabotaging somehow, but in a kind of creative way. I thought that was... in a way, quite a beautiful thing about our band.
Yeah.
You know, it was always about the sort of purity of being creative and not taking the easy route.
Do you ever miss being in a band?
It's not really a case of missing it, you know.
I suppose you've still got the camaraderie of your band.
No, exactly. I mean, we've, you know, toured around the world quite a fair, you know, a fair bit over the last 6-7 years with these brilliant musicians that I'm playing with and brilliant people. And it's a great laugh. I love it. I mean, you know, yeah, it's not a case of particularly missing it. I think, you know, occasionally look back at moments that were brilliant, or you know, some of those American tours, you know, just travelling around with the Foo Fighters and, you know, spending a lot of time with Dave Grohl and Taylor and getting to know them. And those are some brilliant times. And touring with Pearl Jam and playing with The Cure in Brazil in front of 8,000 people. And, you know, some insane moments.
Yeah.
You don't miss them. You don't miss them. You just sort of think they were great.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it's, for me, it's been, you know, and this is not taking anything away from Supergrass, but I think it's been the most productive and creative time of my life this last 5 years, you know.
Well, as a listener, I would tend to agree. Definitely.
Thank you. But it feels great. It's just different parts of life, man. Mm. You know, and I think this is what I'm doing now. This is just the moment I'm in, and I'm going to try and appreciate this moment and live in it, because I don't think I did that enough, you know, back in the day. It doesn't really matter. I was young, and I think when you're young, you'd kind of often, it's sort of seat of the pants, you know. And,
yeah,
and
exactly.
It's a bit like riding a wave, which is kind of how I remember it, a bit of a blurry, you know, fast wave that you sort of try and stay on.
And it's, you know, change is inevitable, and it's progression, and it's maturing as a human being and as an artist. And things are going to change. You're not going to take those left and right turns that you didn't think you'd take.
Yeah, no, for sure. And just that sort of freedom to experiment and to create. And, it's been a sort of magical time for me, actually, you know, last few years. Loved it.
Well, carry on having a magical time, please, Gascoigne.
I'll try.
Thank you so much for coming on.
I've been meaning to get in touch for a long time.
Well,
come and hook up.
I'm pleased we sorted it out, man.
Wicked. Yeah, me too.
Thanks, mate.
Nice one.
And another episode is done. What a fella. I told you, I said I have met one of the nicest guys in the music industry, and that is Gaz Coombs. I'm so happy that he came on. What a thrilling chat. Everything. Music, broken bones, life, tour. It was a banger. So a massive thank you to Gaz and Julie for sorting all that out, and thank you for downloading, subscribing. You know, I say this every week, but it really means so much to me and Griff. Keep spreading the word. And also, if you're up in Edinburgh, make sure you've got to see Amy Booth Steele. I think she's sold out now in Honest Amy. You've got Rosa Hesman-Holsch in Madame Overy. I think she's sold out. My friend Matt Ford is there. Who else is there? Jack Rook is there. There's so many amazing people. Make sure you go and support. Get a ticket if you can. And support us, because next week it's episode 95 of the Two Shot Podcast. And I'll let you into a little secret. I have just recorded episode 100 with a very, very special guest. And we'll let you know in due course. Until then, take care, stay safe, be sound. I've been Craig Parkinson. He's been producer Griff. And this has been the Two Shot Podcast. Take care of yourself. Bye-bye. The Two Shot Podcast is presented by me, Craig Parkinson, recorded and produced by Thomas Griffin for Splicing Block. Our music, our brilliant music, is courtesy of Then Thickens. Cheers.